It's often hard to admit you did something wrong. It might be easy to admit that you made a mistake, but when you did something really wrong, that's hard to admit. At least it is for me. And it's hard because, in part, because of how easy it is to bring somebody into the blame. It wasn't completely my fault. As a parent, I feel often like I'm a judge. When my kids come in with a problem, I feel like I'm in a courtroom, and I am dealing with this court case. Often there's a lawsuit and a countersuit every time. And anytime I end up confronting one child with what they did as wrong, and I'm telling them it's wrong, almost always, I should say, they'll explain how it's not fully their fault. You know, the other person is to blame for at least some of it, so it's not completely their fault. Now, I can't throw stones, though. Can't actually just bring up my kids, right? Because there are plenty of times when Laura and I are in a courtroom of our own. And we have our lawsuits and countersuits. And I find myself doing the exact same thing that my kids did. Explaining how it's not completely my fault. I'm not just owning up to what I did is wrong. I'm saying, well, you know, I did do that. Yes, I did do that. But there's something else that's to blame. You know what I've found, though? I found that when I'm the defendant, the best prosecutor to nail me to the wall is me. I don't know if this has ever happened to you, but usually it doesn't happen right when I'm arguing with Laura, and it happens when I'm talking with my kids. You know, I'm adjudicating one of their problems, and I figure out the problem. And so I want to make it very clear to the child that they did the wrong thing. And so I'm waxing eloquent. I'm making this surefire, clear-cut case. And right as those last words are leaving my lips, I realize I just condemned myself. I had just condemned my child for doing the same exact thing that I had done often to Laura. Has that ever happened to you? Sometimes we need to see our sin from the outside. And we need someone to walk us through it without realizing that we're actually talking about our sin so that we can actually more objectively see, recognize our sin. You remember when the Lord did that with David? There's a story where David had sinned and the Lord sends Nathan. And Nathan doesn't just tell him he's guilty, he gives the story. He tells David a story about a poor man with one sheep and a rich man with many sheep. And this poor man with just this one sheep, he treats this sheep like it's part of the family. But one day, a traveler comes to the rich man, and instead of the rich man taking from his wealth of sheep and preparing his own sheep to feed his traveler, he takes the poor man's sheep, his one sheep, and he feeds that to his traveler. Now, David, he's a king, but at heart, he's still a shepherd, and he is enraged by that story. And he condemns that rich man, only to find out that he's condemning himself for what he had done, a king with a harem to Uriah and his lone wife. So we're back in Isaiah. You can turn to Isaiah chapter 5. We've taken a few weeks off, but we're looking at these introductory parts to Isaiah's vision, and this week's prophecy is going to help us take personal responsibility for our sin. Just as Nathan the prophet had done, and the Lord through him, Isaiah's prophecy is going to very slyly get the people of Judah, the people of Jerusalem, to admit their sin, to condemn themselves by looking at their sin from the outside, looking at it from a story that wasn't immediately about them. It's a story told in song form, at least initially. And so Isaiah is going to sing a song for us, and he's going to have us consider four different angles. Consider that song from four different angles. He's going to have us consider the events of the song, the culpability in the song, the consequences from the song, and then finally the meaning of the song. And in the end, that's going to help us take responsibility for our sin. Not to blame someone else, to acknowledge that we are responsible for our sin. So So let's look at Isaiah chapter 5, verses 1 through 7. And in those verses, Isaiah calls us to consider four aspects of this song. And the first aspect that Isaiah wants us to consider is what actually happens in the song, the events it describes. So in verses 1 and 2, consider the events of the song. Isaiah begins by stating his desire to sing a song. And the question is, whose song is it? What's it about? It's a little confusing. Translations vary here. Some of them, including the ESV, makes it sound like this is a love song. But the wording doesn't necessarily fit that. And if you look at the song itself in the context, it's not really a love song. So what it is, it's a song about Isaiah's loved one. And specifically about this loved one's vineyard. That's what the song's about. So it's a very well-crafted song. I contemplated trying to read some of the Hebrew in front of you because it flows really well. But I don't have the confidence to do that. I can read a few words from time to time. But it is a really well-put-together song. It's very beautiful when it's read in Hebrew. And it begins here with this very simple telling that Isaiah's loved one owns a vineyard. So I couldn't see any translations that really varied from this. They said that this vineyard is on a very fertile hill. The Hebrew, though, is actually more poetic than that. It's just that if you translated it literally, it wouldn't sound so well. So more literally, the vineyard is on a horn of the son of fatness. So you can understand why people don't translate it that way. But that is a kind of poetic image. It's not common in Hebrew to refer to a hill as a horn. It is more common in other languages like Arabic. But you can see the comparison between a hill and a horn. And it could be that this isn't so much a horn going straight up, but a horn coming out from a mountain range. It's just coming out from that range. In fact, if you could really say that Jerusalem was on a hill, a horn coming out from a mountain range. And then the phrase, a son of, and then some quality, that's used to say that this thing doesn't just have this quality, but it's an innate part of it. It's part of its essential being. Fatness or the fertility here isn't just on the hill, it is the hill. It's emphasizing just how fertile this hill was. And then notice the great care that this loved one takes in making this vineyard. Builds it on this fertile hillside. He says he first dug it and cleared it of stones. So it means he dug out all the stones, and he actually used them to create terraces along the hill. And Ken and I saw some of this when we were in Israel. We also noticed how full of stones. I mean, the countryside in Israel is just littered with stones. And in fact, that's a well-known reality for Israel. One commentator, Edward Young, he mentions an Arab explanation for this. They say that when God created the world, an angel flew over it carrying a bag of stones under each arm. As he flew over Israel, one bag broke open so that half of all the stones in the world are in Israel. That's what it looks like when you're there. There's so many stones. So this is no small undertaking to clear it of stones, to build it up, build up this hillside. Even though it's fertile, it needs to have all this work done to it to build up these terraces. Then after that great effort, Isaiah's loved one, he used the best seed he could use for this vineyard. Text says he planted it with a choice vine in the singular because it could be taken as a collective, but because we expect them to plant multiple vines, it's usually translated in the plural, but it's singular. And it could be that this is describing this one vine being planted and then cared for so that it spreads out throughout the vineyard. That is the picture you get in Psalm 80 that talks about a spreading vine, again with a similar meaning. Now, that's going to take a lot of care, though. If he plants this one vine, he's going to have to prune it. He's going to have to continually weed the area so that it can spread out. And the vine itself, it's not going to produce grapes. Once he plants it, it's not going to produce grapes for 2 years. So that's going to give the time that the farmer needed for what Isaiah describes next. He pruned it, weeded it. As he was doing that, he had time to gather some of those other stones that he had cleared and to build a watchtower in the middle of the vineyard. And that's a step up. He could have just built a booth. But he builds this stone watchtower. That's very helpful for either the farmer or a hired hand to keep watch over the vineyard, to protect it from, especially from animals that would want to come in and destroy it and eat it. And these 2 years waiting for the grapes would also allow him time to carve out of that stony ground a wine vat. That's the lower part of this operation that would press the grapes and produce wine. So he's probably just mentioning the lower part to talk about how he's created this whole contraption, this wine press, with a trough that leads down into this vat. The point is that he's not willing to transport the grapes away from the vineyard so that he could lose any of its produce. He puts this contraption, this wine press and vat, there on the site so that he gets everything, all the fruit of his labor. And again, that's going to be hard work. To carve this out is a great deal of effort. So after all this work, Isaiah says that his loved one waited. That's all he had to do at that point. Just wait. He'd done everything to ensure a high quality product. He had every reason to expect that final product. And that's where the story in the song, takes this strange turn. Despite the fertile ground, despite the choice seed and the carefully arranged vineyard, it says that it didn't produce good grapes. It produced wild grapes. Just yesterday, Micah and Luke and I were walking down to the creek in our neighborhood, and we came across wild grapes. And so I was looking them up, and I guess you can eat them. If anybody's saying no to that, okay, so it sounds like I'm not telling people to eat something poisonous. So you can eat it, but they're not as sweet. So if that were the case, you'd think, okay, well, maybe he's talking about wild grapes here. But the wording actually describes something rotten, something that stinks. So these grapes were inedible, unusable. And what Isaiah wants us to recognize is that shouldn't follow. From everything he said, when we consider the events, that final event shouldn't have been the result. It should have produced good grapes, great grapes. It had everything going for it. It had a good soil. It came from good plant variety. It was this well-cared-for space. I mean, he had prepared the ground. He cleared the stones, removed them all, created these terraces that would have included a wall, as we see later. So, as we consider what happened, Isaiah now turns to look at this from another angle. The second aspect that he calls us to consider is who's to blame in the song. Who is culpable? So verses 3 and 4, we consider who is culpable, the culpability in the song. Now, he mentions a specific audience that he's talking to here. He mentions that he's calling out to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the men of Judah. We know that that's the audience from the beginning of the vision. But he specifically states it here because he's starting to let us know a little bit about the meaning. He's just starting to let us know that this vineyard, this song about this vineyard, has a special connection to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the men of Judah. And at verse 3, there is this shift away from the song, and you see that with the words "and now." And there's also another shift. Isaiah, he continues to talk about the vineyard, but that vineyard that clearly belonged to his loved one, he now refers to as "my vineyard." So Isaiah is now speaking on behalf of his loved one. And this loved one asked the people in Jerusalem and the people who are part of the nation of Judah to consider who's at fault, to act as judge. He actually politely asks them to act as judge, to judge between him and his vineyard. Who's to blame for this final result? Who's culpable for these grapes? Is he to blame? Or is the vineyard to blame? And his loved one makes this case in verse 4. He says, "What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done it?" They've already heard about the fact that he provided the best soil, seed, how he carefully laid out this vineyard. It had every chance for success. And so then he asks, when I looked for it to yield grapes, why did it yield wild grapes? Anyone hearing this would recognize that the farmer had every reason to expect good grapes, not worthless, rotten ones. So that they would follow with what Isaiah is saying, what the Lord is saying through Isaiah. And notice that the farmer, his loved one, he believes that there is blame. Someone is to blame for what's happened. There's a responsibility for the outcome. Somebody's culpable. And based on the information that's given, the verdict's clear. It has to be the vineyard. The vineyard had a function it had been created for. It's created to produce good grapes. And it wasn't haphazardly created. It was very carefully created. It had all the elements for success. So you could not blame the farmer. In the end, it was the vineyard that did not carry out its function. It didn't do what it was made to do. The failure to do that was squarely on the shoulders of the vineyard itself. Now that seems strange to us, right? We might look at the situation and we tend to look at things materialistically, right? For example, if you get a lemon car from a factory, how are you going to evaluate that? Got a lemon. So something went wrong in the production of that car. Maybe it was just the whole design. The design's flawed. Or maybe something in the production of it was flawed. But we would know there's a cause. There's a material cause for that being a lemon. It doesn't need to be exorcised of some demonic spirit. There's something that went wrong. That's the way that we think. So when we look at something like this, it's natural for us to think, well, maybe something affected the health of the plant. Or maybe the seed wasn't quite as good as the farmer thought it was. That's not the point of the song. We need to think in terms of what the storyteller is saying. When we're tempted to lay the blame anywhere else, this song will not let us do that. This song is saying that there's no problem with the soil. There's no problem with the seed. There was no problem with the construction of the vineyard. And that's what doesn't make sense. Because the most reasonable outcome, again, was good grapes. There's no other reason for these bad grapes except for the vineyard. The vineyard failed. That's what we're supposed to consider. That the vineyard is culpable for its failure to produce good grapes. So then Isaiah turns to this third perspective on the psalm, the aftermath. What happens next? So the third aspect that Isaiah calls us to consider is what results from what happened, the consequences. So verses 5 and 6, consider the consequences from the song. We see another transition here. It says, and now, and still the loved one is speaking. Now, given Isaiah's profession, somebody listening to this might start to have a clue about who this loved one is. But technically, within this prophecy, the loved one has not been revealed yet. So the loved one states his desire to tell everyone the consequences for his vineyard's failure to produce good grapes. He says, I will tell you what I will do to my vineyard. First, he says he's going to remove its hedge and break down its wall. The wall would have been naturally a part of these terraces. When it dug out these stones, the farmer would have built a wall. And then there was a hedge, evidently, that grew up off the top of the wall. So once the hedge and the wall are gone, the vineyard is devoured and trampled. And that devouring, we've seen that before in Isaiah chapter 3. And when we looked at that, we found out that in Exodus, the same word found both here and in chapter 3, it's used in Exodus to talk about livestock devouring a vineyard. Now, in Isaiah 7:25, the word translated trampled down is used to describe sheep trampling down on a hill. So once these protections are removed, there's nothing to stop these animals from coming in, devouring and trampling the vineyard. But that's not enough. He's not satisfied with that. He adds in verse 6 that he will make it a waste. He's no longer going to prune it. He's no longer going to remove the weeds so that this vine could not continue to be fruitful. And the result of that is seen in the next line. When he removes his efforts there with it, briars and thorns shall grow up. Those would steal the nutrients from the vine. And then lastly, he will stop the rain from watering it. So he's returning it to uncultivated, arid wilderness. All the benefits that the farmer was providing are going to be removed. They're going to cease. And this vineyard is just going to be absorbed into this dry countryside. But notice, and you probably recognize that last line reads, I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. And with that, Isaiah's loved one reveals himself. He says who he is. Because who can do that? Who can command the clouds? Only Yahweh. Only their God could do that. So this is God's vineyard. And he's going to remove all his blessings so that it returns to its original cursed state. You remember the curse back in Genesis 3. When God cursed the ground, what did it produce? Thorns and thistles. These are different words, but you can see the similarity there. And what did the Lord promise his people when he established his covenant with them? If they disobeyed, what would happen? Deuteronomy 11:17 says, then the anger of the Lord will be kindled against you, and he will shut up the heavens so that there will be no rain, and the land will yield no fruit. You will perish quickly off of the good land that the Lord is giving you. So this is the same idea here. God is taking away his blessings, and he is now causing them to experience the curses. These punishments that God promised if you did not keep covenant with him. So he hasn't clearly explained the meaning of the song yet, but you can start to put it together. It's starting to become clear, but before he actually spells it out, I just consider the consequences. Consider what's been said. When the vineyard refused to carry out its function, when it rebelled against what it had been created for, what did God do in response? He removed his blessing, and that blessing was what enabled it to do what it was made to do. So in its rebellion, it cannot accomplish its purpose. The vineyard could only do what it was created for when the divine farmer was at work enabling it to do it. The consequences for its failure is utter ruin. So it still exists, but it's now in a state of utter disarray. There is no way for it to perform its function. That's what God is going to do to every creature who refuses to do what God created it to do. Everyone who refuses to carry out the function that he made them to carry out will experience this utter ruin. So we've considered the events of the song, the culpability in the song, the consequences from the song. And the last thing that remains is what the song's really talking about. So the fourth aspect that Isaiah calls us to consider is what the song is really about, the meaning. And in verse 7, consider the meaning of the song. Now, just last month, they released a documentary on American Pie, a song written by Don McLean. I hadn't had a chance to watch it, but the trailer promises that the secrets of the song are going to be revealed in this documentary. That's really what Isaiah does in verse 7. He reveals the secrets of his song. This is what it's really about. And what he's doing in timing it this way, and the way that he's brought this through, is to catch the people of Jerusalem, the people of Judah, in condemning themselves. See, they would have followed along with this. He's speaking to them, just like he did through Nathan to David, in a way that they would understand this story. They'd connect with it. And without realizing that it was talking about them, they would condemn what happens in it. So that they were a people surrounded by vineyards. They were, many of them, most of them, I would even say, were involved in some way in working with vineyards there in Jerusalem. So this story was right at home with them. They were very comfortable understanding what he was talking about. So when the story takes this surprising turn, when the vineyard produces rotten grapes, and they would have been surprised, and they probably would have been upset. That's not supposed to happen. And given the constraints of the story, they would have agreed with the loved one They said, you're right. I mean, you did everything. That vineyard is just a worthless vineyard. It's not worth your effort. So I'm sure as he's listing out what he was going to do to it, the condemnation, they were saying, yeah, you tear down that wall. You send in the animals. Let those briars come. Stop the rain. At that point, they would have realized what the story was really about. The person, the farmer that they're talking about, that's the Lord. And so it's at that point that Isaiah just tells them what he's doing. He spells it out for him. His beloved is the Lord of hosts. Yahweh, the commander of all the forces of the universe. And now when you think about it, you might struggle a little bit with Isaiah calling the Lord beloved or loved one. Maybe you struggle with that. You don't need to though, right? Because that is the essence of our requirement that God has for us and for his people. Right? Deuteronomy 6:5 commands, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. So the Lord is Isaiah's loved one. It allows him to be vague enough, but true to that reality. But who's the vineyard? Verse 7 says, the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. So just as you have throughout Isaiah, throughout the prophets, there is this poetic parallelism here in these lines. So in the first line, you have the vineyard. Well, in the second line, the Lord describes that vineyard as a pleasant planting. And that agrees with the choice vine. They're both singular again. So the vine, this vineyard's described as something the Lord planted and that brought him delight. That's the idea of a pleasant planting. Something that you plant and it brings you delight. So this divine farmer, he's shown to be expending all this effort to establish this vineyard because he was looking forward with joy to the product it was going to produce. That was a source of his delight. He was looking forward to what it was going to do. The vineyard, it's first called the house of Israel. Now, we know that this vision is directed to Judah, the kingdom in the south. But the prophets, Alec Montier pointed this out, that the prophets didn't always care to distinguish between the two kingdoms. So when they would, even if they were like Isaiah is, referring to the southern kingdom and focused on the southern kingdom, they would refer to it all inclusively, like just saying the house of Israel. Because they are a part of this house of Israel, God's covenant people, the household of that descended from Jacob or Israel. So he gets more specific in the second line. And he repeats himself from verse 3, where he called out to the men of Judah. Now he identifies who this vineyard is more specifically. It's the men of Judah, the people of Judah. So what had they been created for? What were they supposed to produce? Isaiah says he looked for justice, but behold, bloodshed. For righteousness, but behold, an outcry. So when it says he looked for, it's the same word used in chapter 2, or verse 2. So again, you have this idea of expectation. God had blessed Israel, and he should have every reason to expect justice and righteousness as a result. Those two words, justice and righteousness, they're used together throughout Isaiah. They're used to kind of describe a well-ordered society. They're used to basically talk about this is the way things are supposed to be, righteous and just. That's the way that their society was supposed to be. It was supposed to reflect God's righteousness and justice. It's supposed to be a place where people loved one another, put other people's concerns and cares above their own. But that's not what they did. So God had established the kingdom of Israel to accomplish that purpose. That was where his glory was supposed to be displayed. Remember, it was supposed to be a kingdom of priests. I will make you a kingdom of priests. It's supposed to be a place where God ruled, where the people were holy. They served this holy God and they served in holy ways. They put on display God's glorious character. That was what they were created to produce. And again, they had every reason to carry it out. God promised to bless them with all their needs. He promised to meet all their needs if they would do what he created them to do. They would fulfill their function. They wouldn't have to worry about the weather. They wouldn't have to worry about their crops. He promised that he would supply them with perpetual rain and that he would supply them with abundant crops. They didn't have to worry about their prosperity with livestock either. If they loved him and kept his commands. They wouldn't have to worry about having children, having someone to carry on their line, having someone to take care of them when they're old. They wouldn't have to fear enemy nations. Every nation that would have come in would have been routed if they fulfilled their purpose. If they did what they were made to do. If they reflected God's justice and righteousness. And that's not what they did. And it's at this point, again, you have Isaiah, this very creatively, poetically, using kind of a melody with the words. The word for justice is mishpat. Instead of mishpat, they produced mispach. That's translated bloodshed. The word for righteousness is tzedakah. Instead of tzedakah, they produced tzedakah. So he's making these things almost rhyme, like they sound similar. An outcry. It's a beautiful way to say that instead of what they were supposed to do, instead of what they should have found, good grapes, they found rottenness. Instead of a well-ordered society where people cared about other people, they found mistreatment. He found mistreatment and cries for help. So they failed miserably to produce what they were created for. It wasn't like they just, well, it wasn't quite perfect. Like those wild grapes that are, they're just not quite as sweet. No, they were rotten. That's what they produced. The Lord's going to go on to address what this bad fruit is, more precisely, in the rest of chapter 5. And he's going to go in and talk about the punishment at the end of chapter 5 also. But the story has been told. This has been used to set things up so that God's people recognize their responsibility for the failure. That they would realize they are responsible. That there's nobody else to blame. They weren't the kingdom of priests that they were supposed to be. And it was no one's fault but their own. God had done everything necessary for his people to carry out their role. Everything necessary. He'd restored his access with their access to him. No, it wasn't exactly like the garden, but God was still present with them. And he had, again, he as the creator and sustainer of the universe, he would provide for their every need. So what could they point to as an excuse for not listening to him? Well, you don't understand, God. If you'd have just done this for me or that for me, well, then I would have done what you created me to do. The point of the passage is to say no. No, there's no excuse for Israel's failure. And the truth is, we don't have an excuse either for our failure. Romans 1 is very clear. It's very clear that this is universally the case. Ever since the creation of the world, humanity has had everything that we need to honor God and thank him. That's what Romans 1 says. So Romans 1:20 states, "For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made, so they are without excuse." So have you ever thought in your mind of scenarios where a human has an excuse before God for not doing what he created them to do? Have you ever thought about that? Well, you know, if this person lived where we live with the access to God's word that we have, well then to be fair, but it's not really fair because they're on this island out in the Pacific. So you can't really expect them to do what they were created to do. No, that's not the case. There is no excuse for any human on this planet for failing to do what God created us to do. Nobody is going to be able to say on that day that they stand before him, "God, you know, I would have done what you wanted if you'd have just done this or that. You know, if you'd just given me more evidence that you existed, I would have done what you said." If you'd have just made yourself known more clearly, then God, I would have done what you wanted me to do. The fact of the matter is, Israel has demonstrated very clearly that's not the case. That is not true. Did they have evidence of God? Absolutely. Did God make himself clearly known to them? Did it make a difference? Or did they act out their sin all the same? When we look holistically at God's old covenant people, we have a picture of really every individual on the planet. When you look at the nation as a whole, it did turn away. It turned away from what God had created them to do. And because they were entirely responsible for doing what God created them to do, God punished them. That punishment was not unjust. And again, it's a picture for all of us. But even though none of us has an excuse, none of us have an excuse, none of us are without hope. We're not without hope. Jesus would later use a story about a vineyard in line with this story here to talk about, again, the failure of God's people. So we talked about this when we were last in Matthew. Matthew chapter 21 tells a story, slightly different story, about a vineyard. And once again, there's failure. It describes how God sent prophets to this vineyard repeatedly. And eventually he sends his own son. And the response of the people is to reject the prophets. And finally, to such a rejection that they kill the son. And Jesus tells that parable. And right after that, he says not only that he's the son, but that he is the stone that the builders rejected. That has become the cornerstone, the foundation stone for God's temple. So even in their rejection of him, even in this failure that was going to be really the ultimate failure of God's old covenant people, that it was through that failure that God was going to establish the end time temple. That he was going to establish his plans for this kingdom. Through Jesus' death, his rejection, and his resurrection. Now, that's not the only place that you see this imagery in the New Testament. Remember that God's people are described in the singular sense of a choice vine, of a pleasant planting. Jesus referred to himself not just as a vine, but as the true vine in John 15, 1. And it's there he talks about his father being the farmer, and he says in verse 2, every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, and that it may bear more fruit. The only way to produce the fruit that we were designed to produce, now that Jesus has come, is by union with him. There is no way to do what we are created to do apart from union with Christ. He is divine. And when he came, when Jesus came, the Jewish people were supposed to recognize their need for him, just like we all need to recognize our need for him. They need to understand the only way to be part of the end time kingdom, the kingdom that was the fulfillment of all God's plans for his people, the only way to be part of that was through Jesus, the messianic king of the kingdom. That was the only way to be part of it. Through him, through life in him, they could bear fruit as a part of this vine. The vine that he'd always planned for. So that's our hope. Our hope is to accept our responsibility for our sin. To accept our responsibility for our failure to produce the fruit we were planted to produce. To admit that we failed. That we need Jesus. By faith in Jesus, we can be grafted in to this vine. We can be part of this restored vineyard. We can produce the fruit that God intended us to produce. So have you taken that responsibility? Have you taken responsibility for your failure? Have you acknowledged that you have failed to do what you were made to do? Now is the time to face up to that. Now is the time to acknowledge that, to recognize that you have not done what God designed you to do. Because in the end, if you will not face up to that truth, you will experience that utter and complete ruin. But now, you can look to Jesus. You can be forgiven. You can be restored to God. You can be what he made you to be through Jesus. So I just want to tell you, turn from going your own way and trust in Jesus. Believe that he's your king. Believe that he's your savior and follow him. And if you are following Jesus, if you're united to him, united to the vine, just consider one more thing about the application here. Keep in mind that the fruit that's being talked about in Isaiah, this justice and righteousness, can only be produced in the context of other people. This is not an individualized righteousness. It can only be done in the context of a group. Do you know that's why when God rescues us, he brings us into a group? You know, that's why it is absolutely necessary to be an intimate part of a group of followers of Jesus. That's why it's necessary for us to week in and week out be with this group. Because that is what God saved us for. That is what God created us for, to function within a group of people. You can't love your neighbor if you're not around your neighbor. So we are gathered into the church when we become disciples. That's why we need to be committed to a group of Jesus followers. So we can listen to what he's commanded us, and we can apply it in a genuine way. See, you can say you love somebody who's a stranger that you see every once in a while on the street. You can say that that's love, and that you're doing what God calls you to do. But love is very, very different when you're around people all the time. When you're around people that you wouldn't necessarily naturally be with. Hopefully you're not a part of this church because it's just people like you. Hopefully you're a part of the church for the right reason. And when you're a part of a group of people that are different and vary, and you love them week in and week out, that's going to be the challenge. That's going to be a harder love, isn't it? That's going to be a real love. Not the one that you can trick yourself into thinking that you're doing when you're off on your own, doing your own individualized faith. I'm a good person because, you know, I did this nice thing for this person that I never see again. Before I was married, I thought I was a pretty loving person. I thought love was pretty easy, too, honestly, you know. But when you're in close proximity with someone, when you have a close relationship with them, you find out how hard real love is. It's not easy. You find out just to what degree you are a sinner. And you find out that many of your attempts at love were really just matters of convenience. They weren't real sacrificial attempts at love. So be a genuine part of this people so that we can begin to do what we were made to do, even now. Yes, you can do that some with the people outside of here, but this is where we're supposed to begin to reflect the kind of justice and righteousness that Isaiah is talking about. This is where you can be pruned. This is where those things that aren't quite right are going to be seen and noticed. When you're an intimate part of a group of people, it gives you a chance to, through interaction with them, through conversations with them, to see, oh, you know what? What I'm doing isn't quite right. And that's how the Father prunes us, by his Spirit, so that we become more and more Christ-like in our love. So now that we've experienced God's saving grace, do we have any excuses for not doing what we were made to do? Is there anything that we can say, oh, I have an excuse as to why I can't do what I was created to do? We don't. 2 Peter 1:3 says, his divine power has granted to us all things that pertain to life and godliness through the knowledge of him who called us to his own glory and excellence. You and I have all that we need to be godly, and we've been called to God's own glory and excellence. That's the direction. That's what we're pursuing, right? So when we fail, and we will fail, I think this ties really well into what Andrew was talking about last week. It's not perfection, it's the pursuit of this glory and excellence. So when we fail, what this text is teaching us to do is to own it. Admit it quickly. Confess it. Acknowledge it. It's again like Andrew was talking about. Ray Ortland gave some good examples of excuses that we can tell ourselves. He says, we tell ourselves, if only I had more time. If only I had a better wife or husband. If only I were married. If only my job weren't so demanding. If only I had more money, I'd really live for the Lord. He says, these are all excuses. At bottom, each one implies a criticism of God, as if he hasn't already given us all we need to live well for him. This passage is teaching us that there are no excuses. It is not teaching us that we're going to be perfect. It's not teaching us to expect perfection. It's teaching us that when we sin, and we will sin, to own that we're responsible, to own it, to say, I am responsible for that sin, no matter what situation I'm in. No matter what the other ongoing circumstances is, we're not to be like I so often can be and to say, well, yeah, I did the wrong thing, but oh, this is why I did the wrong thing. We have everything we need to do the right thing. When we do the wrong thing, it's our fault. So we need to say that. When we fail, we fail. When I fail, I fail. Fail. When you fail, you fail. We're responsible. That's what Isaiah teaches us. So we need to accept that so that we can grow in God's grace to be what he created us to be in Christ. Join me in prayer. Father, we are so thankful that we speak of grace. That you know who we are. That you know that we are sinners. And we know we are sinners. We have to know that we're sinners to be followers of Jesus. True, genuine followers of Jesus. But we can still be tempted to fail to own up to our sins. Fail to take responsibility for what we have done. Instead, blaming someone else, shifting the blame to what other people have done to us. Father, help us to see that we cannot do that. That there's nothing about your sovereign care over us and placing us in the circumstances that we're in that in any way implicates you in our sin. Instead, everything we have for life and godliness is at our disposal so that when we fail, it is us that is failing, and that we would be quick. Father, by your Spirit, convict our hearts to be quick to admit that, quick to accept that we have sinned, that we are still sinners in need of your grace, that we would turn quickly to you. We would not have to face discipline and your correcting hand. Instead, we would be able to turn quickly and glorify you in your grace and forgiveness. Father, for anyone here who is trying to do things on their own, whether they are followers who are trying to live the Christian life on their own, just do it on their own as though this is an individual task, an individual thing, they'd recognize their great need for the body of Christ. Or Father, if it's somebody who doesn't think they need you, don't think that they're really that bad. But your Spirit would open their eyes to see the truth. That apart from you, there is nothing good in us. The only good comes when we are in connection with you. That they would see that. They would recognize Christ as King, as Savior, as the one who rescues us and forgives us and restores us to you. They would follow him. Ask it because of what you've accomplished in him. Amen.